Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Danish director Susanne Bier, who has a really interesting career that has kind of pulled a lot of talented people into her orbit. So I wanted to talk about her movies and the people that are in them, and start by talking about her in terms of being a Danish director. If you look at all of the credits for most of her movies, actually for almost everything seemingly that comes out of Denmark, almost all the scripts are written by Anders Thomas Jensen. So this thread goes throughout not only her career, but also Danish film. There's also, you know, a little bit of dogma theory going on or in their early stuff. But Mike, I want you to, you know, give us a quick overview of dogma and how Susanne Bier fits into your Scandinavian film course.
Yeah, in the course I teach on Scandinavian film, when we get to Denmark, it's essential to talk about this because as you get into the 1990s and then into the 21st century, there was a movement called Dogma 95. Lars von Trier is the most famous or infamous of the directors associated with that. Thomas Vinterberg, who made films like The Hunt, and Susanne Bier is of that generation. And essentially with Dogma 95, you know, in some ways it was meant as a promotional, I don't want to say stunt, but it had promotional value. In other words, you know, European directors like to issue manifestos in a way that Americans typically don't. And these guys, and plus Susanne Bier, were serious about this. But by the same token, it explains why we're still talking about it today in this way, because they had a list of beliefs, of tenets, of things that the dogma called for. And in their own films, they more or less adhere to these. Sometimes they don't so well. But again, it's a provocation, deliberately provoking people, trying to get us agitated in a way to rethink cinema. So anyway, in a nutshell, going against the conventions of a well-made film in terms of studio-type filmmaking, they wanted films that would use natural light, real locations, handheld cameras, only diegetic sound, you know, sound that was actually occurring in the immediate environment, very naturalistic performances, a kind of quasi-documentary quality in some ways. And so from the 1990s onward, this was what they were calling for. This was the provocation. And when you watch their films, you can see it play out to varying degrees. And to our point at the moment, Susanne Bier's films, many of the early films certainly very much adhere to this. I mean, there's this, it's a philosophical approach as much as a technological one of how films should be made, what they should say. So Marie, let me hand off to you at this point, because, you know, again, that's sort of the philosophical backdrop. She's part of that movement, a kind of, you know, I would say loosely defined movement, but they're rather stringent in what they were calling for in the document. And then they go off, of course, they're having their individual careers. So let's talk a bit about her early career.
Well, I wanted to start in terms of the dogma movie Open Hearts from 2002, because it is, you know, an attempt at a dogma film, but like most of the dogma films, it immediately dispenses with some of the rules of the movement. So this does break with some of the rules in that the blood used in the car accident scene is theater blood, not real blood, where there are fantasy sequences shot in Super 8, and they also use some tricky cameras. So, you know, they broke the rules of dogma, but in other ways, you know, it is meant to feel very realistic and gritty, like, you know, man on the street with a handheld camera kind of thing. It does have Mads Mikkelsen and Nikolaj Lie Koss, who went on to do many other things, not just in Danish film, but in international film in general. And that takes me to Brothers, which came out in 2004. And this to me is the quintessential Susanne Bier movie. And this is the one that I use as an example in my class of the use of the convention where you have, when you're exploring the duality of nature, where you know, there's somebody has a dark side and also a light side, a good person inside of a bad person and vice versa. And one of those conventions is to have brothers or even twins who embody the two things. And this sets up Ulrich Thompson as the good son in the family and Nikolaj Lie Koss again as the bad son. And the movie opens with that setup. That's the family dynamic. And Ulrich Thompson ends up, you know, going off on a military expedition and helicopter is shot down and they think that he's dead. So the brother that's left is, you know, reaching out to his sister-in-law, they're both trying to deal with the grief of losing this person who's not just their brother and husband, but just an all around great guy. And they end up becoming romantically involved, only to find out, guess what? He's fine. And he's on the next plane home. And what comes back is the shell of a man who left, because what has happened after his helicopter is shot down is that he is imprisoned and at one point has to kill the radio technician that has been captured along with him. And this decision that he has to make, you know, for his own survival, absolutely shatters the man. And he comes back just destroyed. And he cannot admit to what he did either, because it's just so bad. So he comes back just a completely different person and unable to talk about it. So it's a very visceral, personal story, which they tried to remake with really actually great actors, Tobey Maguire, Jake Gyllenhaal, and Natalie Portman in the American remake. But somehow the American remake completely misses what makes the Danish version so great, which is this very real sense of what is lost when you experience something like that.
Yeah, we should talk about brothers in this respect as well, that when the one goes off to war, specifically goes off to Afghanistan, the reason I'm harping on that is, I think it is her strongest film. I think Brothers is probably her most characteristic film, her strongest film for the reasons you've identified so well. And there's that family dynamic, that tension between two brothers. How oftentimes her films do have that, right? Not just within a family, but like two siblings or something, or within a marriage or something, or one marriage and another marriage. You know, she's really good at that kind of tight focus there, like laser sharp focus there. But the topicality of it, this ties it back in. We double back onto what I said earlier about Dogma 95. You know, it's not one of their bullet points necessarily, but inherently it is, namely the topicality, dealing with modern life, contemporary life issues. So it's not like going off to a generic war, it's going off to Afghanistan. The movie's released in 2003, 2004. So at the point at which things like that are relatively fresh conflicts in the headlines, if you will. And so she's playing off of that. In that regard, too, that strong contemporary focus, and it dovetails thematically and technically with all the Dogma 95 technology of, you know, the kind of camera to use, the way to shoot something, where to shoot it, and then, you know, the scripts themselves that play off of modern life. I was reading a review of Brothers by Stephen Holden in the New York Times, and this is a very quick quote, but I think he's talking specifically about Brothers, but I think you could take this short quote and apply it to almost any of her films. And so here goes. Holden says, you know, that she's dealing with, quote, events worthy of Greek tragedy through a contemporary therapeutic lens. And that's the interesting thing there is that, you know, if you look at some of the, like in Open Hearts, which we talked about a few moments ago, you have this like out of nowhere tragic event. There's a young athlete who's just about to be married, and then he's suddenly paralyzed in a car-related accident. And just, you know, the things that life throws your way that you wouldn't have predicted 5 minutes before it happens, right? But here it is, how do you respond? And then all the plot complications, all the family dynamics or marital dynamics going from there, okay? Or in Brothers, where you have, you know, these two brothers, their relationship, and then what happens when you go off to war? And, you know, first of all, are you going to come home? And if you come home, what kind of condition are you in? Everything going from there. And so some of those are primal situations that I think Stephen Holden very correctly identified as like worthy of Greek tragedy. You can imagine these basic situations in Greek tragedy, but through a contemporary therapeutic lens. There's very much that analytical quality to Suzanne Bier. And I don't mean that she's cold as a director, but she's analytical. And this is why many of her films, if you just gave a plot synopsis, depending on how you phrased it, might sound like, I don't want to say potboilers, but melodramatic, right, in terms of stuff happening. But when you watch the films, they always really remain, quote unquote, realistic. She could push really far into melodrama. By she here, I mean like with the camera, with the script, she and her screenwriters, they hold back enough that there's a kind of cool regard. I mean, Marie, do you agree with that? That even though the films themselves get really volatile emotionally, the film overall, in terms of a directorial stance, is a bit more, I don't want to say detached, but let's say observant, you know, taking it in, presenting it.
I would also maybe say restrained in a way, because it does ask you to ask yourself the question, if your only choices were either to be the hammer or the nail, which one would you pick? And then the other part of that is that a lot of what is the violence that's implicit is off screen. It's really what is happening in your own head as you're filling in what the sounds sound like. So it's it feels like you've been through a real emotional experience when you're done with the movie, but it isn't necessarily gory. It's more psychologically effective.
Yeah. Let me follow through on that crucial word, restraint. You're absolutely right. The situations are often out of control, right? Like really volatile, just like the worst things that can happen in life are the most vexing problems. But the film itself is cooler in some ways, more restrained. And since I've been on a run here of quoting Stephen Holden from the New York Times, let me backtrack there because it's directly to your point. When he was reviewing Open Hearts, he had a similar response to it. And let me give a quote here because I think it ties together things you and I have been saying here. Here's Holden, quote, "Because Open Hearts follows the austere rules of the Danish filmmaking collective Dogma 95, it purveys a documentary style realism that dilutes any lingering soap opera gloss. The rough-hewn visual style matches the bite of Anders Thomas Jensen's screenplay, which pounces on all the painful issues of affliction, sex, and death that you half wish the movie would sidestep."
That is a really great quote, and it really does kind of describe that film very, very well. The last thing I wanted to say about Brothers is that they did not advance that for consideration for the Oscars, you know, push forward something else, which obviously didn't win. And Danish film producers really wanted to press the issue. So after everything was said and done, Brothers went on to win several awards, including Sundance Film Festival, and got stellar reviews. So the jury later admitted that they probably chose the wrong film to send to the Oscars that year. And I agree, because I think the original is absolutely stunning. The remake is somehow forgettable, even with the same material and really good stars. No shade on anybody acting in it, but just somehow the underlying psychological examination just gets lost in maybe some little bit of overacting. But that does bring me to 2006 and After the Wedding, the movie that I think was what really made her visible, because it was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, the first one in 16 years, and didn't win. A couple of years later, she would win an Oscar, which I think was meant really to give a nod to this movie. And this is one, again, written by Anders Thomas Jensen. Apparently, they don't let anybody else in Scandinavia write any movies but this guy. And it's a wonderful story with Mads Mikkelsen in it. And it's one of those, it reminds me of sort of a Mamma Mia kind of story where you find out later that, you know, you have more relatives than you expected. But this is told in a, you know, here's Mads Mikkelsen in his, you know, world where he's, you know, this guy who's a good person and he does, you know, charity work. And then he's drawn into this intrigue in this Danish family. And then he has to choose, does he stay or does he go? Does he go back to what he was doing? Does he make a different way forward? And it's, again, very Suzanne Bier in that she takes some element of human life and divvies it up for you to dissect and see yourself in several different characters and then try to make sense of the mess that the plot makes. What do you think, Mike?
I think you're absolutely right that this is the point at which she's becoming known internationally. When we talked about Brothers and Open Hearts, those are the early 2000s. She's moving a few years further into that decade by way of international distribution, international recognition, and those Oscar nominations, absolutely. I mean, she's getting recognition here. And I think it's the film that we, for some of us, it might've been the first film of hers that people saw. Brothers had some distribution, but I think After the Wedding, tell me what you think of this, Maria, that After the Wedding was really the one where people took notice.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, because that's actually, I think, the first movie that I saw of hers. And after I saw it, I went back to see what else she had done. So, you know, that was where I would put the pin, and then you know, flash back to the older stuff and keep following going forward. And I think it's a fantastic movie. The 2019 remake with Julianne Moore and Michelle Williams and Billy Crudup. I mean, again, great actors, same material, somehow didn't work the same way that the original did. Why is that, Mike?
Well, it's funny you say this, because the same thing happened with Brothers, where, you know, international recognition includes American producers seeing good material and deciding to do our version of it. I'll draw an analogy with yet another Scandinavian film that gets remade by Hollywood, Let the Right One In, the Swedish film. One of my favorite vampire movies. It's a really great film. And I did not feel the need to have it remade, right? The English language remake of it is a perfectly respectable film. It's well done. It's not quite as cold, and I mean that in various ways, as the original. Something gets lost there. It becomes a more conventional film. And I know that's kind of a, you know, non-descriptive way of getting at it. In other words, I'm not being as specific as I would love to be here as to what exactly goes wrong. It's more a matter of there are certain qualities, almost intrinsic qualities in the original material that doesn't always translate well to an American studio remake. And just as Let the Right One In was, you know, the remake was okay. The American remake of Brothers was okay, right? The remake of After the Wedding was okay. And as Marie said, you know, you get some strong actors. You know, when you have Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore, I'm not complaining. And watching it, it's fine. But you know what? And I'm stubborn on this point. When the original film is so strong, and then they do this sort of so-so, you know, remake that doesn't have anything egregiously wrong, but then again, nothing incredibly right about it, I'm sitting there the whole time asking myself, did we really need this remake? In other words, and that's an emotional blockage as much as anything. So even though I haven't been quite as specific as I'd like to be in terms of, well, this scene and that scene and how, you know, the one's better than the original, on a very general gut level reading, I'm watching the remake of something like After the Wedding thing. Well, I was satisfied with the original. I didn't feel the need for this. And what I'm watching is okay, but why don't you turn your attention and your financing to some original material, to something that you come up on your own rather than copying something that was done elsewhere. Do you think, Marie, that might partly be it? Because again, we're not like, I'm not specifically identifying a particular scene or two that would be better in the original than in the remake, though I could do that, I'm sure. But just on a more general level, philosophically, let's put it that way, philosophically, I'm almost like in principle opposed to.
I'm opposed to remaking movies that I think were perfectly fine as they were. I could see the value in remaking a film that you think didn't get made quite right, and you think you could somehow enhance it or make it better. But that brings us to the fact that, like a lot of talented people, and Hitchcock comes to mind, as soon as you start getting some success, suddenly everybody wants to work with you. And so she's, you know, after the wedding, suddenly she starts working with everybody. And so in 2007, she makes Things We Lost in the Fire with Halle Berry and Benicio del Toro, which is an okay movie. I don't think it was one of her best, but you can't beat that lineup. And then in 2010, she makes In a Better World, where she does win the Oscar. And I have mixed feelings about this movie. The Danish title, by the way, translates as Revenge. And Suzanne Beer mentioned that she prefers the English title In a Better World, which emphasizes the hopefulness of the film, while the Danish title emphasizes the severeness of the film. Maybe that's the problem with all of the remakes, Mike. That's a possibility. This would be her fourth collaboration with Anders Thomas Jensen. And it's about, well, it's about several kinds of revenge, but one is, when, you know, what do you do when somebody humiliates you in public in front of your child? How do you model good behavior that doesn't get you beat up? And, you know, like we were just have been discussing with Suzanne Beer, she tends to take these tough questions and then really make you look at them. This also has Ulrich Thompson in it, and he's fantastic in it. And what's kind of like the After the Wedding role that Mads Mikkelsen plays, where he's straddling two worlds where, you know, he's trying to raise a child, but he's also distracted with his life where he does good deeds and is a good person. So you have lots of examples of fathers trying to do the right thing with various results. It also has Kim Bodnia in it, who I think is just a wonderful Danish actor. I think I've liked every movie he's been in. But what was your take on this movie, Mike?
In terms of her career at this point, she has started working, you know, we were talking about Danish films, two films she made that were remade by Hollywood. And then, you know, so Hollywood's taken notice, right? And she's getting Academy Award nominations and so on. So a couple things are kicking forward for her at this point. She's actually working in Hollywood. Things We Lost in the Fire in 2008. It's not a great film, but it has some emotional power. I mean, there's some strong material, and Halle Berry and Benicio del Toro give really good performances in it. She makes some other English language films starting in this period. I mean, there are actually several at this time, and then there'll be in the most recent decade that we're just coming out of now, some more English language films. So she's working in American filmmaking as much as Danish, but still she returns to Denmark periodically and makes films. And In a Better World in 2010 did win her the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. So she gets that prize. all the attention that goes with it. In terms of what you were saying, Marie, about the, I'm not crazy about the film either, actually. I mean, I think she would have deserved the top prize more for, you know, Brothers or other films, but, you know, it's on the shelf and good for her, right? It's there. So it's a worthwhile film. I don't think it's a particularly great film, but let me give a quote from her as to what she was trying to do in A Better World. She says, quote, "Our experiment in this film is about looking at how little it really takes before a child or an adult thinks that something is deeply unjust." And again, that whole sense of, you know, she really is a very moral filmmaker. She's really ethically inspired. Again, everything we said earlier about family dynamics, brother versus brother, whatever, or married couple versus another couple. But she really worries about those things. But again, there's a bit of detachment there in terms of the camera itself, in terms of the vantage point. And I think, Marie, you're right to constantly underscore the fact that she generally works with the same scriptwriter. Because after all, filmmaking is collaborative. And whatever kind of tone or attitude you want to talk about towards the material, well, surely that's in the script as much as in the camera, right? So I think you're absolutely right to identify the screenwriter there. There's a certain consistency, in other words, that way. And so I think actually she's been blessed in the sense that her American films have not been big hits, but they've done well enough that she's still able to get more work, you know what I mean? And she's also blessed in the sense that she seems like she can go freely between making a film in Danish or making a Hollywood film. I mean, my sense is that she has that, it's a luxury really, you know, that she can go back and forth like that. What's your sense of that? Because I think she's in a really good, she's 60 years old now and she's got quite a filmography. And now that she can kind of float between Copenhagen and Hollywood, I think she's got a pretty sweet deal going.
I think that you're absolutely right. And to your point about, you know, working with, you know, Americans or English speaking actors in different audiences, in 2012, she goes on to make Love Is All You Need with Pierce Brosnan. The original Danish title, by the way, is The Bald Hairdresser. It's about a hairdresser who's lost her hair to cancer, finds out her husband is having an affair, goes to Italy for her daughter's wedding, and meets a widower who still blames the world for the loss of his wife. And Pierce Brosnan said he was attracted to the role in part because he was widowed after his first wife, Cassandra Harris, died from ovarian cancer. And then she goes on to make A Second Chance in 2014 with Nikolai Coster-Waldau from Game of Thrones fame. And then in 2014, does Serena with Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, which they did just a couple of years after having done Silver Linings Playbook together. Which brings us to 2018 and Bird Box, which I think a lot of people watched on Netflix because it had so much buzz about being about what it's like to be blind. So hundreds of people, you know, tried to mimic this film by, you know, trying to travel a distance while being blindfolded indoors and outdoors. And, you know, videos started showing up on social media of people bumping into things and hurting themselves. Netflix finally had to issue a statement to discourage people from taking the Bird Box challenge. And Sandra Bullock said she was blindfolded for about 50% of the shooting schedule. But, you know, other than the stunt of it, Mike, what did you think of Bird Box?
Well, I'm not a big fan of it as a film, but I'm intrigued by it as a phenomenon. Because Marie, as you identified there, people really did, you know, glom onto it. And I mean that in a positive way, that there's something about that, like kind of a what if, you know, what if you were blind or, you know, what, and people would respond that way to it. And so, you know, here we have her working in more of what we could call a post-apocalyptic horror film mode. And so even though she's coming out of Dogma 95, there have been occasional films. And actually, you know, I think in terms of her career, not feeling she has to always work within a particular mode. I mean, what's your sense of that? It seems to me that this is one of the films, Bird Box, while I'm not really crazy about it as a film, it shows that she's looking to push a little further that way by way of genre or by way of approach. Because, you know, she's had earlier films where there might be the occasional bit of fantasy or whimsy or this or that. But this is a film, Bird Box, where I think she pushes further that way. And again, because it's in a more American mode here in terms of the kind of horror film that, you know, we're comfortable with, if you can be comfortable with a horror film, and also working with actors like Sandra Bullock. Goodness knows Sandra Bullock is an American actor, right? So, I mean, you know, kind of working within that industry. What's your sense of that? Because it really does somewhat change the parameters of this Danish director who has that Dogma 95 background, you know, pushing into a different genre or taking melodramatic or extreme material and pushing it somewhat differently than she might have, let's say, 20 years earlier in Denmark.
I think I agree with everything that you said. I think it was an opportunity to try something different. I like that she did it with a female star like Sandra Bullock. It was probably an opportunity for both of them to try something. And in a way, it feels a little bit Dogma-like, you know, because it is trying to get to the heart of something that's mostly, you know, covered up by artifice and cinematic trickery. So we're coming down the home stretch here. I did want to mention The Night Manager, which is a TV series that she did with Hugh Laurie and Tom Middleston in it. I mean, anything with Hugh Laurie in it. But the series got 12 Emmy nominations. So, I mean, it's been very well recognized in terms of the awards on that side of things. And they're based on stories by John le Carré, who actually appears in some uncredited cameos. So if you go back to look up some of the episodes, he's a museum guard in Our Kind of Traitor, and as a diner in episode 4 of The Night Manager. And one other little fun fact about that is that Olivia Colman convinced Suzanne Beer to cast her as Angela Burr, even though she was pregnant, reasoning that it worked for Frances McDormand in Fargo. And, you know, once she put it that way, it was kind of hard to argue with her. But the last thing I want to mention is that, you know, currently working on The Undoing with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant. So that's just a really interesting couple of people I think would be great in really anything. I think I would watch anything with those people in it. The premise is life for a successful therapist in New York begins to unravel on the eve of publishing her first book. So this will be a first collaboration between those two actors with a Danish director. And I can't wait to see how that turns out, which brings us to the end of our segment. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.